Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about prairie dogs and the upcoming Prairie Dog Festival. And we will also be talking to Barbara Mayfield of Stark Raving Beauties, who is presenting a Sadie Hawkins Day extravaganza. Right now, I would like to welcome Angelo Jaramillo. He is the author of the new book, Psalms of Anarchy, published by Sunstone Press. And he will be doing a book launch this Sunday, March 2nd at 3 o'clock at the Santa Fe Public Library. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning. So, Psalms of Anarchy, that you've got two words there that have very different flavors. Psalms evokes sacred songs and poetry. Anarchy evokes violence and chaos. How'd you put these two together? What was the inspiration for your book?
It's kind of funny the way that title developed. I was kind of at a loss for the title of this collection. And I actually had a book in my hand of a collection of Leonard Cohen's poetries. And I think it was called Songs of Mercy. And just the name Songs started ringing out. And he was mentioning how a lot of it was lamentation towards God and trying to glorify or beautify or understand just the existence thereof. And the songs, I was thinking about it, of naming something with songs. And then kind of Psalms evolved out of that. And then he mentions a lot of Psalms in his work. And so I was reviewing my work after all. I kind of focused on Psalms first, and then Anarchy. I kind of figured that exemplified a lot of what these pieces represent, and not just what people think of anarchy as far as, oh, it's just chaos and disorder, but there's actually like anarchism, which is a very philosophical, political type of way of viewing life and trying to organize society. So it plays with both those kind of ideas, and I kind of put it on the back cover of what it underlies everything. And this is what it means to me anyways, to glorify the God that remains steadfast in his or her opposition to humanity's inconsequential achievements. But Psalms also has a lot of the lamentation in it, and that's why the second book, because I broke it down into three books, Depression, Lamentation, and Emancipation. And Psalms goes along with a lot of the lamentation, and Anarchy kind of goes with the emancipation part as far as not submitting to any kind of authority.
Well, that's what I was going to say. What does anarchy mean to you?
Exactly that. That there's the old saying that there's no masters, no gods. And to me, it's more of like an individual way of liberating yourself. It's a philosophy. It's a way to approach life for me. Not exclusively. I'm not dogmatic by any means, and I don't subscribe to any party of any sorts. But it's just another form of way to view life, to think about life, and then to incorporate it into your own existence to liberate yourself in order to hopefully empower others so they can liberate themselves.
So the three sections, Depression, Lamentation, Emancipation, did you conceive of those as you were, after you'd written the pieces, or how did that come together? Did those words inspire some of the poems?
That came about towards the end of putting the collection together, because a lot of these pieces were written over a period of about 6 to 7 years. I mean, some of them were since I was in college, and then most of them were written right after 2003, after the Iraq invasion, some in between after September 11th, and then all the way up to a year ago was maybe the last piece included. So when I was putting it together, I kind of realized how certain pieces had a theme going, and then I kind of wanted to tell a story of an individual voice that went through this process, kind of like growth of, first there's this depression of realizing the kind of world you're living in, and you feel helpless and you don't know what you can do, and so you turn it on yourself. Then there's this lamentation because you have a sense that there is something better than your own world and than what you see around you happening. And you just express this woe. And it's not necessarily depressive, although there's still elements of that, but it's also like a wailing, a freeing of your voice, of not holding it in anymore. And then Emancipation is, most of those were the political character, and most of those pieces were actually public pieces that I had written for certain events that were going on shortly after the invasion of Iraq. and I was able to present these in Santa Fe to a diverse crowd, to various people, and that's basically, that was like my final say as far as trying to push the limits of freedom of speech so I could not only help myself, but hopefully still keep alive that spirit that, you know, if anything, you can still say what you need to say. Maybe not, it's not about what you want to say, it's about what needs to be said more so.
I was wondering, as I was reading through them, if a lot of them were meant to be spoken aloud, that a lot of them have sort of internal rhyme structures and a kind of rhythm that suggests that they're spoken word pieces.
Yeah, fortunate enough, my first poetry teacher was Valerie Martinez, who teaches at College of Santa Fe, and I had her for several classes at Highlands University, and she was, it just kind of happened unintentionally as far as keeping the oral tradition alive. That's how I started learning what poetry meant. She really instilled that in like my heart and my mind, and then my ears. When I write, my ears kind of pay more attention to my language than my head a lot of times. So there is a lot of that public presentation, and a lot of these pieces have been presented publicly first before I even considered publishing them on the written page. But I also felt too, though, that it's good to read them sometimes because you get a different flair than when you actually hear it. But many of these pieces are definitely public performance or just displaying it in public first.
Would you like to read a piece?
Sure.
You know about FCC regulations.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
We're talking to Angelo Jaramillo.
I'm going to read a piece from my first book. From the first book of Psalms of Anarchy called Depression. And this piece is entitled First Life of Labor. And, well, it kind of underscores what that depression really was. Just contracted HIV wasn't hard enough for safety. Condoms tore what a sighing bore it is to live. Fell asleep today, midsummer breezes forgotten, the sleaze bags, the owners of property, the unaccounted lives shot. Lectures of terrifying peace, cardiograms required every month. Lepers look as beautiful as pink dawn seen through serene smoke screens. Feet sizzle, blood trickles, no time to waste except your own. Not even a raw turkey bone could cure the amplified hound's woes. So much for this and that, so preoccupied with death. I saw my mother naked again, sing a song bereft. The auditor at my closed door knocks, pounds with heavy face. Happiness ended when I became a permanent member of the rat race.
Angelo Jaramillo, there's a lot of poems in here that are, I mentioned the FCC, because there's a lot of very strongly worded poems that come from, it seems like to the reader, a sense of hopelessness and rage at the same time. And do you write from that experience? Do you remember that experience and write from a more tranquil place?
I would figure like about almost half of it comes from a lot of that place, because at the time, well, rage can be taken both negative and positive. Like, I was listening to Rage Against the Machine a lot. They were a big influence in how I developed my lyrical aspects of what I write. And sometimes that's just needed, just to put it in focus as to being aware that there are these different kind of hostilities in an external world, the world around you, you know, personified sometimes. Sometimes you might think it's your own imagination. And then that's kind of when a lot of the hopelessness starts to set in, or feeling powerless and not really knowing where to focus your attention or energy. And I can remember many a times just being there in front of the computer alone in a room, silent, and no distractions, and writing for hours on end, and not really thinking about it consciously, but just allowing it to come out, because I knew for me personally it was a way to get rid of a lot of that hopelessness. It was not...
Did it work? I mean, that's what I always wonder, is when you get that out on the page and craft it, does it actually kind of take it out of your heart?
Oh, yeah, definitely. For me, that's what I was actually trying to... I hope that point kind of gets across when you read the whole book in its entirety, because Emancipation at the end was really expressing all of it, and at the end, I don't think it is hopeless. I think that, I know me personally anyways, that I'm more involved, I'm more engaged with society, with people. I'm trying to do what I can to contribute. on a very, you know, I can't do anything great. Like Gandhi once said that what you, no matter what you do is insignificant, but it's important that you do it. And so I kind of stick with some kind of simple things that I can do in life to make a better change for people that are around me and for people that, even that I don't know personally, but I can always lend a helping hand. And so I know for me, it's been a great overcoming of a lot of different personal obstacles to really overcome depression and woe and to find some sense of life to where something's better.
It's funny, yesterday we had city council candidates on the air and they were talking about how Santa Fe is a place that's not very friendly for young people who grow up here and then when they come into adulthood, even finding a place to live that they can afford and finding work and so on. And then these themes come up again in your work in a completely different form. And I wondered if you could talk about your experience of being a, you know, young Chicano man in Santa Fe today.
Whoa. It's it has its ups and downs. On one hand, I feel like an endangered species. I feel like I know a lot of people that I grew up who were young and Chicano from here are not here anymore. They went to Phoenix, they went to Rio Rancho, Albuquerque, Texas, Denver, wherever, California. And a lot of times I'm just meeting new people from all kinds of different places and gaining a different experience. But in my case in particular, it was a unique experience because my mother was the first woman mayor of Santa Fe, and everybody knows who Debbie Jaramillo was that was here at that time. And you know, there's a lot of controversy, as they like to use that catchword, but for me, it gave me an invaluable education as to who I was and to the type of world I was living in. But in Santa Fe in particular, I'm facing my own struggles right now as far as trying to just afford to survive here, much less, I can't even think or fathom about buying a house, you know.
Which is unprecedented in the history of this town. I mean, for hundreds of years, people's children could build a house right next to their parents' house or down the street.
Right. And now a lot of people, even on my neighborhood, in the Torreon neighborhood over there by Alto Park and Camino Alire, a lot of people, there's some people who try to stay, but a lot of them left. Even their families packed up and left. They just, I don't know, it's not always about they couldn't afford to stay here. A lot of them didn't want to stay here because they felt there was nothing in this city to participate in anymore. And I know it's hit my house personally, and the only way I can really deal with a lot of it is to write books. That's the only way I can try to express that or try to come to some truth or understanding of what's happening, but it seems to always be 10 steps ahead of me. And in my own destiny that I'm creating for myself now, there's a lot of good opportunities coming my way, but it's still a struggle. I underline everything by struggle. A lot of people, I think, do, regardless of your background. But for me in particular, it's like, well, I write for The Reporter, for one, and that has been both positive and negative. And just this morning, there was a very hostile letter written to attack one of the reviews I did on Benchwarmers, the local play. And I like to play with ideas of local and who's not and whatever, but I never try to take it as serious as I think some other people might take it, just as serious to reflect what maybe I'm trying to say. I don't know if that makes sense. But there was a mention in there about not being able to speak correct English. And to me, that's like the most racist thing that you could possibly say to someone whose mother tongue is Spanish, but had to grow up learning English and still who's trying to learn Spanish. And that's like a big cultural divide or cultural neglect in a young Chicano's mind who grew up in an English world, who grew up with American values, who grew up, you know, as any other American from Virginia or from Tennessee or from California. There's not much different in that homogenization.
They were criticizing your English?
Yeah, they said that not only that I didn't master, that I abuse English, that's not the word they used, but he also said, he made a point that I used this word loquacious or loquacity, and then he said that I was trying to impress my readers or something like that, and like I didn't know what that word means, you know, or like I'm incapable of understanding big words or I don't know English, and yet my bachelor's degree was in English, and not only that, I actually appreciate the English language for what it offers as far as, I mean, that's what I write in. I don't know how to write in another language.
In Spanish, yeah.
Yeah, and even if I did learn Spanish, I would still write in English, or, I mean, it's my first language.
How do you feel, I mean, part of the tension inside of Chicano identity for a lot of people is being cut off from that sense of having lost your native language, or having your native language is English, it's not Spanish. What's that like for you?
It's devastating in a lot of ways, but it's also motivating because, well, you know, there's a lot of Hispanic people who they'll speak Spanish, but they won't teach you Spanish. And if you try to learn Spanish amongst them, they'll just display their own arrogance as, oh, rah, 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 whatever, you know, barata, rah. They'll, like, pronounce it with a flair, you know, like Spaniards. And to me, it's just like BS, you know. It's like, okay, you know what, fine. You don't want to be my brother or sister and help me with this. Then that's fine. I'll go learn it somewhere else from someone else. And then the way I look at it with language is our thoughts. And inside your head, if you think in Spanish, it's a whole different way. Like when I talked to my father, who his first language was Spanish, grew up in a whole different era and up north. And the way he thinks and the way he sees the world, it's very poetic. It's very, there's a lot of parables involved. There's a lot of allegory, a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of romantic notions. And it's not as direct sometimes, or it's not as defining. Like with me, English, a lot of times it's about finding the word to define a word. And I try to incorporate, I know it comes out a lot in my work where there's this lyricism that I don't know exactly where it comes from, but I think it's part of my cultural roots, it's part of my heritage as far as just being of that blood and race of La Raza, but it's my own, it's nobody else's. And so I take Chicanismo, it's very personal to me, it's something that's part of my identity and who I am and that I cherish and value, but I don't try to throw it in the face of other people. I just try to address certain issues that I see happening with people interrelating with one another. And I don't always do it, and like, you know, we kind of see Obama as someone who's trying to bring peace about. And someone told me that you say the same things Obama says, only he does it, you know, in a peaceful way, and you do it in a more confrontational way. And I say, well, that's true. I say, I'm not, you know, I'm a writer. I'm not a peacemaker. I'm not an ambassador. Although I want peace, I want love for everybody. But sometimes I feel like you just got to throw it out there. You got to slap them in the face, and you got to slap yourself in the face and wake up, and then maybe we can get this all out.
We're talking to Angelo Jaramillo, and his book is called Psalms of Anarchy, published by Sunstone Press. What are the political issues locally and nationally, but particularly locally, that have really lit your fire?
Well, locally, part of the more macro, I guess, or socio-political issues that I've dealt with mentally and socially that I think are realistic, actually, and it's in this book a lot, is the idea of imperialism, of American imperialism. And I've, with this book in particular, I've related a lot to how it affected me here in Santa Fe with the onslaught of newcomer Anglo-Americans, for the most part, that have come and stayed and increased, you know, the cost of living in a lot of ways, or have really turned this whole city into a whole different world. It's not the same as it was even 20 years ago or 10 years ago when I was growing up. But I try to relate that to the global level of, like, when America went into Iraq and took over there basically for oil, for energy, to give fat contracts to Halliburton, whatever. But it was a form of imperialism that I don't think has ever stopped since the first colonists landed on this in the East Coast and started working their way west and, you know, eradicated a lot of the native populations. And I think still that Western expansion is still happening. That manifest destiny is very real. It's not something that's abstract or that distant, but only more so now, I think, a lot, like with technology and the way, the fast pace of how everything moves, a lot of it penetrates into the personal, into the spirit, into the intellect. You know, people are brainwashed, people are indoctrinated, people have to assimilate, people have to accommodate on both levels. But for me, I feel for the most part that I'm a subjugated, I'm part of a conquered people. I don't feel as part of the mainstream American society, even though I know I'm trapped in that. But I try in very many ways to resist that as an artist.
What does that resistance look like? I mean, what kind of a mass movement are you part of or would like to be part of that resists that subjugation?
Right now, I think for the most part it rests on the cultural level as far as using art as a way to defy that. But I try to go beyond that in my everyday workaday life to assist as much as I can with people who I know who are barely making it. Like, for instance, almost every place I've ever worked in town, without mentioning the organization, if I saw poor people going into the store and couldn't afford, like a single mother, you know, she has her three kids, you know, her kids want to buy something and they don't have the money to do it, I would go out of my way to either find them a discount or even buy it for them myself. Something simple, something to do, something to bring a little bit of hope or cheer into someone's life that may not be getting the creme de la creme, that may not be part of the upper crust, that may not be benefiting from what is to be benefited from in a very materialistic, obsessive, extremely wealthy part of the world.
And so, I mean, you're talking about, you know, equalizing differences that are inherent in this society, and you're also talking about compassion. Have you gotten, it sounded like you were implying that you've gotten a little bit of flack for that.
Oh yeah, I've been told many a times, it's always don't do that, or there's always been reprimands that have happened, or I've just ended up moving on to a different place just because I felt my time was served. And I'm thinking more so of work, but as far as what I've done, like I used to teach theater in Arito back after college in 2000, and I wrote these plays for the kids there who, you know, a lot of the hype was that these kids have nothing to do and they're getting in trouble. So I started this theater program, I wrote plays for them that I thought they could relate to, similar to the material I write. And I got censored and I got fired just the day before the opening night, and we ended up putting on the play anyway, and I had poetic justice in the end, but it was a experience I'll never forget because it taught me that there are certain ideals that are worth facing whatever persecution or whatever injustice that you might have to confront. And I learned a lot from my mother as well, as taking a stand. Maybe you don't know everything, or maybe you're not always right, but you take a stand on certain issues that you know and you believe in your heart that you're not wrong because you're seeing the wrongs outside of you. I think if you don't see that, then you might be wrong. But if you're seeing a lot happening and other people are testifying and other people are suffering, and you take a stand against that, you're going to face very powerful enemies who, they might leave you alone for a while. And again, I'll quote Gandhi. At first, they laugh at you. Next, they attack you. And then you win. Something like that. I'm paraphrasing. But I kind of stick to that as far as what I'm doing and what I'm going to continue to do. I'll always be with those who I think are less fortunate, and who those I think are with me, as far as they're not getting what it should. I think everybody should have a nice place to live, you know? I don't know, there's a lot of people that are just suffering unnecessarily.
Angelo Jaramillo, unfortunately our time is up. I want to thank you very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. The book is called Psalms of Anarchy, and Angelo will be at a book launch for this book on Sunday, the 2nd of March at 3 o'clock at the Santa Fe Public Library. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the Prairie Dog Festival. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Darby McQuaid. He is the owner of Jackalope, and Nicole Rose Marino, who is the Wildlife Program Director of Wild Earth Guardians. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us, Charlotte.
It's great to have you. Now, the subject of today's conversation is the Prairie Dog Festival, which is coming up at Jackalope. And that is the 1st of March, which is this Saturday.
Right.
This is an unusual store that, you know, sells folk art and arts and crafts and objects from all over the world, but you actually have prairie dogs on the premises.
We do, and we also have burros and lots of chickens, and we have peacocks, and we believe that retail should be entertaining, and that's a big part of it.
And now, prairie dogs are an endangered species or borderline endangered species. Nicole, what is their actual status?
Well, they are not legally protected as endangered species, but biologically they are endangered. Gunnison's prairie dogs are the species we find here in Santa Fe and at Jackalope. and they deserve protection. And so I think, you know, Jackalope having the Prairie Dog Festival is really important. It's important to celebrate these native species and also to encourage their protection because they certainly need it.
What are you going to actually be doing to celebrate prairie dogs on Saturday?
Well, we're going to have educational talks about the importance of prairie dogs, and there's also going to be music, right, Darby?
There will be music, two groups, one of them with Jerry Ferris, and I don't remember the name of the others, but they're here for another concert, and they're going to be there. They're supposed to be great. And then we're going to have four groups that will have tables and literature and speakers, and they are the Defenders of Wildlife, Wild Earth Guardians, Prairie Dog Pals, and People for Native Ecosystems.
And just for our listeners who haven't been tuning in very regularly, Wild Earth Guardians is the new name of Forest Guardians, which merged with another organization, but you're basically doing the same things.
We're doing more in more places. We've expanded our program scope as well as our geographic scope. We're now looking west-wide to protect wildlife, wild rivers, and wild places in the American West.
So let's talk about the coexistence of prairie dogs and human beings in developing landscapes. That is something that we are facing in Santa Fe all the time.
Yeah, we really have a problem in Santa Fe. We've documented that over the past decade, Santa Fe has lost 80% of its prairie dogs. And certainly I know Jackalope was inspired by the onslaught of development to protect the prairie dogs that are on its premises. And that's really important. We also need more colonies protected in the city. And where there's just unresolvable conflict between human development and prairie dogs need to be safely and humanely relocated to safe places. And that's one of the things we're really pressuring the city on, is to accept a conservation plan that we submitted to them 2 years ago, which would outline how to protect some colonies where they exist in the city, and also to establish a rural preserve network to restore prairie dogs to rural lands and allow prairie dogs and the ecosystem they create to flourish.
Now, prairie dogs have very tight family structures. They are social animals. They even have language. If you relocate some prairie dogs, what is it like for them? I mean, can they just go to a new place and thrive as if they were, you know, moving into a motel six counties away or something?
It has to be done very carefully. As you mentioned, their social structure is quite complex, and so you need to keep family groups together. You need to respect the territories that were existing on the prairie dogs that needed, the prairie dog colony that needed to be relocated. It needs to be done very carefully. Nest boxes have to be installed.
What boxes?
Nest boxes. You have to auger new burrows and implant these nest boxes so that the prairie dogs don't just pack up and leave from the new site to which they're taken. You can have really low survival rates or really high survival rates from translocation, depending upon how much care is taken to ensure that it's done properly.
When you have looked at relocation projects, is there follow-up to see whether the prairie, I mean, how do you know it's the same prairie dogs? How do you know how do you follow up?
Well, that's really a good question, and it's very important to do. I know at the Wind River Ranch, where some prairie dogs from Santa Fe from the airport have been taken, there's the ranch manager is a biologist, Brian Miller, who's very carefully looked at the kind of survival rates that can be obtained from translocation. Paula Martin has been a relocator in the area for a long time, and I know carefully tracks survival rates on the new colonies.
We're talking to Nicole Rosmarino from Wild Earth Guardians and Darmy McQuaid from Jackalope. So where do your prairie dogs live in the sprawling compound that is Jackalope?
Excuse me. They're situated between the Mercado and the furniture store. We literally built the new furniture store It was located based on where they are, where the prairie dogs already were, and it's about a 25 feet across, I think, something like that, maybe 30. My younger brother Michael built it in 1990, and it's of all the things we do there, unofficially, just by asking people, if I ask 10 people, what's your favorite thing at Jackalope, 8 out of 10 will say the prairie dogs.
Wow, as opposed to the pottery or the baskets.
Exactly.
Incredible. It's funny that you're having prairie dog day today, because from my wanderings in the prairie dog park near my house, they're not out yet. I mean, not today, but a few days from now.
The first one came up, I think, three days ago.
Really?
And surprised me, because it's been a very cold cold spring. And our manager who's in charge of the yard and the animals guaranteed me that they would be up by the 23rd. And and there it was. And I checked, and last year the first one was seen on the 22nd. So
prairie dogs have calendars in their burrows underground.
So.
Yeah.
When do prairie dogs breed new prairie dogs? When are the young born? What time of year?
They'll be born in a couple months. But we're starting to enter into breeding season after they emerge from hibernation. And then March and April is very important for breeding season. And then we see the young of the year up in May or June, depending on the elevation within the range, which is pretty large, of the Gunnison's prairie dog. They're located in four different states. But I do want to applaud Jackalope for celebrating a native species, the prairie dog, which is a species that for the past century has been heavily persecuted. And I think it's great that
there are people who shoot them for fun. I mean,
yeah.
when I saw images of this, people shooting them as if they were inanimate, you know, little carnival toys.
Yeah, it's archaic, but it's true. And in New Mexico, there are absolutely no restrictions on prairie dog shooting, and that's inexcusable and something we're trying to change. In Colorado, we're trying to get prairie dog shooting banned outright based on state law. They have some seasonal closures to protect prairie dogs during the breeding season, but we think for ethical reasons that you just mentioned, this practice needs to be abolished. We shouldn't, in the 21st century, be allowing native wildlife to be used for live target practice.
What time is the festival on Saturday at Jackalope?
It will be from 11 to 3. Like I said, there will be speakers, there'll be music, there'll be fun. And I wanted to mention that we will be celebrating prairie dogs, and for a lot of great reasons, especially the ecological reasons. But also at the event on Saturday, we'll be putting a plaque on the prairie dog enclosure for a lady named Donna McGuire, who was the person who came to see me and convinced me that it made a lot of sense ecologically and humanely and as entertainment for our customers. And she worked tirelessly in Santa Fe doing this relocation on her own and protecting and defending. And she died a number of years back, and we really wanted to put a plaque on the exhibit about her, and also mentions my younger brother, who actually single-handedly dug and built this. So that will be part of the celebration also.
He single-handedly dug and built what now?
The Prairie Dog Village.
The Prairie Dog Village. Now, were there prairie dogs living there already?
No, she trapped these, I believe, at DeVargas Junior High or something. I'm not certain of that. And but she brought them there. He dug down 16 feet deep hole by 25 feet across, and built using old cinder blocks and things, built this thing. And
said, little doggies, here you go, your new home.
And she brought them, and we had lots of publicity and cameras waiting. And she let them out. There's a big mound. They came out of their out of the cage she had them in one at a time, ran up to the top of the mound, looked around, stood up straight, looked around, practically bowed, and then went down. It was wonderful.
Nicole Rose Marino, we have just a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about hibernation. I mean, probably we learned this in elementary school, but I've forgotten. How do animals actually hibernate, like prairie dogs? How long do they sleep, and are they really asleep, and what do they do during the hibernation period?
Well, not all prairie dogs hibernate, but Gunnison's prairie dogs tend to. It depends on the winter. If there's a warm winter, sometimes they'll be out in the middle of the winter. But in general, they do hibernate. They go down in October, November. Again, it depends on the elevation. It's really critical before they go into hibernation that they increase their body mass, so that while they lower their activity level and basically go to sleep for a couple months and really lower their metabolism rate, that they can survive the winter from those fat stores.
So they eat a lot of fats and carbohydrates?
Yeah, they eat a lot of seeds and leaves and stems of vegetation and bulk up for the winter and then start emerging around now in our area. But again, there are variations depending on elevation. And, you know, I think it's important to understand with the hibernation schedule that it is vital to only relocate prairie dogs within a safe window. So during the summer months, as you get closer to when they go into hibernation, you can really have very low translocation survival rates if they go to a new place and don't have time to bulk up in order to survive the winter. So basically the story is of a creature with very specific needs, and we need to be very careful when we manipulate these animals to ensure that those needs are respected. And I think most importantly, we need to protect more colonies where they exist in the city. That's critically important, that the pace at which we're losing these animals from our city is unsustainable. Pretty soon we're going to look around and wonder where all the prairie dogs went. So we're urging folks to contact their city councilors, who have been provided with copies of our conservation plan to preserve some colonies in the city, move other colonies to safe places, and establish this preserve network. And so folks can get online, email their city councilors, and say, we really want to do better by Gunnison's prairie dogs in the city of Santa Fe.
Prairie Dog, the Prairie Dog Festival is at Jackalope on Cerrillos Road this Saturday, the 1st of March, from 11 to 3. Darby McQuaid is the owner of Jackalope. Nicole Rose Marino is Wildlife Program Director at Wild Earth Guardians. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you for having us.
And if people would like to find out more about wildlife preservation, prairie dogs in particular, how do they reach Wild Earth Guardians?
Folks can visit our website at wildearthguardians.org.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking to the marvelous Barbara Mayfield. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Barbara Mayfield of the Stark Raving Beauties and Sally Blakemore of the Sally Blakemore Orchestra.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Hi, Mary. And hello, Santa Fe.
You just called me Mary.
Charlotte.
Thank you.
Just a delayed thing. She's in a delayed time thing, like a 4 second, like a cell phone.
I've known Sally
Mary.
Blakemore for 18 years.
19.
I think we're past that.
Right.
Now, Barbara is presenting a Sadie Hawkins Day comedy extravaganza this Friday, Leap Year Day, the 29th of February at 7:30 at the Cowgirl on Guadalupe Street in Santa Fe. Tell us who Sadie Hawkins is.
Well, Sadie Hawkins is thrilling. She was a cartoon character in Al Capp's cartoon, and
in the 30s,
way long ago, and it was not a very complimentary thing. She was like the homeliest, the most unattractive girl in the hills. And so on the day out of time, leap day, she was allowed to, go after a guy. And this is sort of a twisted thing. Really, November 15th is Sadie Hawkins Day, according to the ALCAP Sadie Hawkins Day Society. I looked it up.
There's a society.
There's a Wikipedia entry for everything.
But we're paying no attention to any of that whatsoever, because Leap Day is the day out of time when I feel strongly, Mary Charlotte, that this is a holiday about the simple, primal, carnal desire of women.
Does such a thing really exist?
Yeah. You need to come to the show. Because we'll be discussing this topic in a dignified way.
Yes.
Is that possible?
With music.
So tell us about the performance.
Well, I can't give it all away, but I'm going to just do
my thing.
Is it
just you? Is you it's solo with the Sally Blakemore one-woman orchestra?
No, Rusty Storbeck is playing on the African marimba.
Yeah, there are two people. The orchestra just came together, last Wednesday?
Wednesday.
And it's brilliant, okay? So I've got this, and every good comedian needs an orchestra, I have found. So Sally,
and a drum roll.
Thank you, Sally. And a drum roll, and castanets, and accordions, and stuff.
And then the ba-dum-boom at the
whatever.
End of the punchline.
Yeah, we'll work it in. So I'm going to do my solo comedy thing, but I'm never alone. I have the Star Craving Beauties, which, are my alter egos. So there'll be a few, two maybe, there's a new Star Craving Beauty.
Really?
Yeah.
Another one of your multiple personalities?
Yeah. No, come on. Yeah. My characters. This is sketch comedy.
All right.
This is an actual profession, okay? This is not a disorder.
She's schizophrenic.
No, come on. This is... Does people say this about Chris Rock? No.
They might.
If he had the Star Craving Beauties, they might. But anyway, we're getting into deep water here.
We're getting into psychoanalysis when we want to talk about performance. You have multiple characters. Mm-hmm. Who are some of the characters whom we have met in the past whom we might meet again soon?
You might meet Frau Schechter again, the intuitive scientist moisturizing maven, who has remedies for every possible world problem, local, regional, national, and universal. And then there's Sandra Canyon Lance, which I think she's tied up this time, but she's the fastest therapist in the West.
How does she do it?
She just, get over it, you know?
Does that work?
Yeah. In her office, it totally works. And then one of my faves is Miss Revlon, the doll before Barbie, who is a real doll. Do you remember Miss Revlon, Sally?
I do.
See, that's why Sally's orchestra is involved with the Star Craving Beauties, because she knows. My sisters had Barbie dolls, I had Miss Revlon.
What is Miss Revlon?
She's a blonde bombshell, but she's got an actual human woman figure. Mm-hmm. She's not elongated, and her toes, she's not standing on her toes all the time.
Uh-huh.
She's just smaller pumps. Yeah. So that's her. And who else? Violet Swan, the torch singer, who's got another gig that night. But like I said, there's a new one, but I can't reveal yet who it is. But it has to do with national security.
Oh.
Which ties in really nicely with Sadie Hawkins Day, I feel. I have found the connection.
So what, Sadie Hawkins Day is the day where the girl is supposed to, Sadie Hawkins is supposed to ask the boys out with the intention of matrimony ensuing.
Yeah, you can either ask a guy to dance or to get married, but now that it's 2008, you could also possibly do an illicit proposition. Instead of a proposal, it might be propositions.
Ah.
Okay?
Things are faster in 2008.
Yeah, and global warming's happening. We got to hurry.
We have very little time left to enjoy and revel before it all goes down the...
The landmass is shrinking. It's get on it, as they say.
And the orchestra, our orchestra, is like the original orchestra on the Titanic. We will play until our noses are under the water.
Right.
That orchestra being you and Rusty.
Yes.
Now, what are all the instruments that you play?
Oh, we're going to play an extended marimba that's three octaves, the Italian accordion. So we're doing Afro-Italiano, and then we're mixing in a cowbell because we're at the cowgirl.
Right.
And a snare drum because we need a drum roll.
Right. Because every orchestra needs a snare drum.
Yes.
Now, this does bring up the whole question of how liberated at this point, at this advanced stage of our Western civilization, are the relationships between men and women, where this whole realm of dating and amorous pursuits are concerned.
Yes, it does. Yes, yes, it does. Well, but we're trying our best to ignore it.
Even you're ignoring it. You're doing a whole performance about
yeah.
it.
This is probably be a pretty darn unabashed heterosexual show, don't you think, Sally? I mean, well, you know. So, what do you think we do?
Actually,
theorize
the
about this?
Roles are so much apart. It's a stylization of like relationship role playing. So it can go into homosexual world or any kind of romance.
Okay. Good.
We do have.
Yeah, that's what we're
going
to do. Do you have a question about that, Mary Charlotte?
No. For once, I do not.
Okay. We're going to, you know, there'll be an, you know, if anybody is out there who would like to make a proposal, you know, if there's a guy they want to propose to, they will be given an opportunity during the show.
Do they have to bring the subject to the show?
Well, if they're going to propose to them, yeah, probably.
So, are you going to have like a mass proposal moment at the Cowgirls?
It's sort of like
not just an opportunity, 30-second or so opportunity, possibly if it comes up. I can work it in. You know, why not? It's Sadie Hawkins Day. Plus, it's that day out of time. Anything could happen. See, because I don't really get Leap Day. Like, why are our watches and computers not exploding on Friday? I don't get it.
Because we have some very sophisticated computer programmers who are able to fix all that stuff. It's like Y2K.
If only I could get them on the show.
I know.
If they could stop in, we
what,
could
are you
talk
exploding?
About it. Well, maybe. During the program. No, yeah, we're going to be talking about, you know, the relationship stuff and liberation, maybe.
Well, what is liberation? What is the liberation of women all about?
What do you think, Sally?
Youth wants to know.
Don't get me started.
No, start. We've got 2 minutes left.
Oh, 2 minutes. Okay. Well, personally, I think we're in a major flux right now where patriarchy is going out. It's totally going by the wayside. The matriarchy is here, and we're standing on it. It's the Mother Earth power coming up through our feet to be able to ask men out, to be able to marry, to be able to choose who we want and the kind of partner we want.
Oh, well, okay.
Having been married for 29 years, and this is my
third
husband.
Yeah, but to multiple people.
Yes. 29 years,
oh, really?
One man,
oh.
And five on one, three on the other. But
so,
anyway.
Sally, you're going to be throwing him over then on Friday, right, and going after a new guy? Is that it? That's
we'll be
your
offering Rusty up for a new partner. Hi, Rusty.
Rusty, just kidding.
What are your feelings about the emerging alleged emerging matriarchy?
You know, I'm totally into the matriarchy as long as it loves the patriarchy. As uh-huh. long as there's this balance thing that happens.
Mm,
I'm
the
not,
balance.
The balance thing where it's very, you know, there's respect, there's love and appreciation for both sides and what women have to offer and what men bring to the world and relationships.
Which would be what?
Which would be, what would that be?
Well, right the way I see it.
I'm sure there's something. I know there is. I remember there was something.
Picture a seesaw. The man is on the bottom. The woman is on the top right now. He gets off. We're done.
Yeah.
So we want a balance. We want
Absolutely.
Power of both genders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, recognized and respected. And that's what we're going to be talking about and making fun of on Friday.
And the event on Friday is a Sadie Hawkins Day comedy extravaganza with Barbara Mayfield and the Stark Raving Beauties and the Sally Blakemore Orchestra, composed of the matriarchal Sally and her... and her non-patriarchal husband, Rusty Storbeck.
That's right.
It's at 7:30 at the Cowgirl, which is at 319 South Guadalupe Street in Santa Fe. This Friday, Leap Year Day at 7:30, Barbara Mayfield and Sally Blakemore, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank
You're welcome.
You.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And
Party
you can find out more at barbaramayfield.com. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, James Carter. And on Sunday at 4 o'clock, the Forum on KSFR features William Stewart, Ed Brown, and Greg Bemis discussing the upcoming local election. John Greenspan will moderate. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.